Hello, heroes, and welcome to Backstory. I'm your host, Alex Roberts. Heroes, I had a wonderful Gen Con. Thank you so much to everyone who came out to the one-shot fan panel and hangout on Saturday night. And especially, actually, to those of you who stopped by the Pelgrane booth to say hello to me. That was really wonderful. I always like getting to meet listeners, by the way, so if you ever see me at a convention, I really do hope you'll stop and say hi. Your next opportunity to do so will be at Big Bad Con in October. I'm going to be a special guest there. So if you are in Walnut Creek, California, that's just outside of San Francisco, on October 13th to the 15th, it's a smaller, really play-focused, incredibly friendly, incredibly welcoming convention where I had the time of my life last year. So if you can make it, I'd love to see you there. More details on that as we get closer to the date, because I'm going to be running games and stuff. So for today, my guest is Alex Rowland, brilliant LARPwright and expert in the emerging field of in-LARP counseling. If you're intrigued by that, well, so was I.
So Magisfall is actually the last game I participated in.
Cool. Well, I definitely wanted to spend some time asking you about that, actually, because I know that you and Brody Atwater were doing some really interesting stuff with the counseling role, right? Because Magiscola is Magiscola had a built-in school counselor role last year in their first few runs, where this was like a character who was totally a character in the fiction that students could go to as like their school counselor, but also they were serving this like non-diegetic role as someone you can also just like debrief with, or like who will check up on you, or if you're not having a good time, you can sort of unload on and get a little bit of care from. So I know that they were kind of hoping to bring that role back, but it sounds like you and Brody really expanded on what they were doing.
I think some credit can be given to us. I think there's just been a really good, there's been a lot of communication in the safety design portion of LARP, which is like very small, let's be real. Mm-hmm. While we were there, we did take, we pushed a lot of things that we maybe normally wouldn't have, and came up with a lot of really interesting results that we're definitely going to, they're going to be like, they were written about in that Nordic article, that article in Nordic LARP, and then they're going to be like really, really, really expanded on and Brody and I's touchstone that we're working on.
So I want to ask you about this like guide that you're working on, but first, like just for our listeners who maybe haven't gone to a LARP with someone in that role, what do you feel that the role of a counselor specifically in developing like an overall culture of care?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I think a lot of people fully don't understand it. I know even my friends who are in LARP and are in Kansas City, who I even write with on a regular basis, don't really get what I do when I like fly across the country and do this embedded counselor role. It's an embedded role, and that like it's in character and out of character. And that allows us to perform several tasks in terms of all in pursuit of like mental health and trying to provide like a certain wellness to players and really the atmosphere of the game itself. But there are a lot of things that we do. I think really the core of it is if I really, really believe, and there's like a lot of super important attributes that LARP have to offer us. And I think a lot of people who, especially who go to these like larger, these blockbusters in the US and are really interested in like consent systems and sort of like the new, like the cutting edge of American LARP, if you will, they're really interested in these like transformational experiences or all the benefits of LARP on your mental health. And I think we are there to like make sure that people get that, to keep them in play, you know, even if if they're bothered in some capacity. We're like standby emotional labor to keep them in play so they can, you know, really keep receiving those benefits At least that's my perspective. I know that differs from a few other LARP counselors.
Yeah, I've spoken with some organizers who, in many ways, think about the counselor role, not just for what they can do for the players, but also, like, I think you're doing a tremendous service to the organizers.
Oh, I hope so.
Yeah. what do you see as being, like, being part of that team? What kinds of things do you bring to that space?
That's a really good question. Because I think we are at once, like, very much part of, like, the staff, and, you know, we like to be introduced to players as part of the staff for, you know, a myriad of reasons. But I think it is also sort of a free agent. Like, you are not on anyone's timetable but your own, or you're like, in my case, I usually work with a partner, so, you know, we usually schedule those. And you know, we are pretty much left alone the majority of the time, with the exception of, like, players, right? Or staff reporting issues to us. So it's a very, very dynamic role that, like at Magic School, I really didn't have much contact with organizers or staff. I was really entrenched in either out of character sessions or, you know, sort of doing diegetic work that we're doing now to help people out in various fictional ways.
Yeah, I really want to ask about that, because besides the sort of, like, crisis response and, like, de-escalation of, you know, relatively minor mental health stuff that can come up, what are the really kind of LARP-specific kinds of work that you're able to do in that role?
Cool. Thanks for asking, because this is something I'm super duper excited about. The way we kept finding these issues that were arriving, they were, like, sort of, you know, they were affecting the person, right? Not so much the character, but they were their derivative from play, such as, like, a good example is I have bit off, like, way more than I can chew, and I've scheduled all these scenes, and I'm in all this really important plot with other players, and it's the end of day two, and I am very, very, very tired. I'm just realizing that, and I don't know how to resolve all that, or resolve even, like, a personal, you know, a very important personal arc to me, and that's a really, really loaded situation, because that arc could be very important to your experience, the personal one, right? And it's sort of become tertiary or secondary or what have you to everything else. So, and that causes people a lot of worry and can really, really make or break the experience from then on. And this was something that was coming up more and more. I first sort of encountered it at Event Horizon when I was counseling there. And then it became very, very frequent. And at Jiscola, just because of the way it's designed, there's just so much you can do, right? And so we started taking upon ourselves, being Brody and I, Brody refers to them as diegetic devices or diegetic diversions. And we've been essentially running, like, black box scenes for them, which is to say, that thing, okay, so it's we're at the dance. All chances to, like, resolve this super important thing for you are gone, essentially. But I can pull aside a player and, you know, in 15 minutes, set up a black box scene to, like, wrap up everything for you because of sort of the inherent mechanic flexibilities of black box.
Right. So you're able to work as, like, a sort of GM-ish type role to do these things that are in fiction that then, because people feel resolved in the fiction, they feel more relieved in their real emotions. Oh, wow. I feel like there must be more elegant language to talk about that, but I'm just trying to, like, take it apart. That's really interesting.
We're getting there, I think. we're trying to develop some, like, language that's a bit more descriptive and, you know, in Brody and I's case, academic, because that's sort of direction we're approaching this, because we are both have, like, counseling backgrounds. I'm working on my master's right now. And so there's a lot of, like, cross-pollination between, like, synergizing real world psychology, counseling skills into this sort of this really eclectic, you know, small field we've built for ourselves.
So this isn't just something that you and Brody want to keep doing and being, you know, the counseling cabal. It sounds like you really want to do some recording work, like laying down that foundation for others. Are you working on like a guide or like something that resources that other people can access if they want to have this role?
Yeah. So we are trying, we're really about proliferating a lot of things right now, which I realized is a bit, which is like more welcome than I thought it might be. So, but like, for instance, in terms of counseling, we are in the process of putting together a fairly in-depth touchstone regarding, you know, procedure, a code of conduct, and really, and what would be almost, you know, it's a probably a book worth of information that would allow people to take on this role, but to do so responsibly, because I think that's a lot of people's fear is that to be put in this position is not only like a lot of responsibility in terms of, you know, taking care of people properly, but also that, you know, that you do so respectfully and like in a legal capacity as well.
How do you get around those concerns? Like, that stuff is so American.
Oh, yeah.
In the sense that it is like intimidating, a little bit foreign to me. And we can also talk about how a LARP counselor is not a therapist. But certainly a piece of that is like, when you start thinking about things like confidentiality, you know, or duty to report and all of those things that don't apply to you because you're not acting in the role of like a professional, you know, psychotherapist. How are you grappling with that right now?
It's largely about accountability right at this point, right? Is that even if I have the education to diagnose something, it's not my place to in that role. So someone might be suffering from symptoms of like of a personality disorder, and I'm not going to tell them that. That's like not my position out into the world. That's not my responsibility. My job there is to make sure that they are taken care of and the environment is taking care of them, and that they like can enjoy the experience. And so right now we're being kind of unfortunately gatekeepery, which I think is ultimately fine, about like who should do this, because it comes with a lot of authority and trust. And if you abuse either of those, it can have really sort of catastrophic consequences.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Like when you think about, hey, does anyone want to be this person who lots of people will come and be vulnerable to you?
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of the wrong people could like raise their hands in response to that. Massively, massively.
So yes, yeah, certainly people will do that. Just as there are like bad people in LARP, right? And you need to, it's part of the job is, you know, not necessarily like seeking those people out and like doing something about it, but being able to manage them. You know, not necessarily as counselors, but as being a counselor, your job is to like, you know, to sort of to spot people who might be, you know, sources of negative mental health might be triggering for people, might be problematic. And that's something that to do so responsibly and ethically is something that really is also something you pick up in counseling, right? Not something, I don't really trust your given, your everyday person to be able to suss those things out and then manage those handily and efficiently.
That's interesting. I mean, what kinds of advice would you give to people who are organizing ongoing LARPs and who want to have this kind of role?
I think it's really important to, if you're going to have this sort of, this layer of protection, I think you have to ask yourself, does my game need it? Let's be honest, maybe all games don't. And if you do, how much, right? Do you need, if you need a counselor, think about why, and then think about realistically, do you want someone untrained doing those things? So it's a bit of a jump in my mind that like you either have no counselor or like a trained psychologist on staff. So I think there's these like intermediate people where there's just like, you know, do safety design. That's important. And have someone there who is capable of doing emotional labor, right? that I think you can have people who are not counselors who are there to sort of do dedicated emotional labor, right?
Right, right. As long as you're realistic about the boundaries around what they can provide.
Absolutely. That's a huge thing in the code of conduct that I'm working on right now, which is sort of a hack of federally recognized standards by like several organizations. And it's very, very, very clear about, if you're in compliance with this document, that you are aware of your own boundary. It's not really your boundary so much as like your own capacity to help people and where that becomes dangerous. And so that's something we are really, really pushing for. I think we're really pushing for just for you to call us.
Yeah, that makes sense and is fair and responsible. Two last things I want to ask about the counselor role.
Sure.
One, in a school setting, it makes sense to have this like school counselor, right? In Magiscola. What other in fiction character roles do you think would be well suited to having this out of fiction responsibility?
That's good. So I have done this as several entities, one being like the Magiscola counselor. Mm-hmm. And if you've been there, you know they're either like a Whipple or a Watson. Those are like the archetypes you play as a Watson, but a counselor nonetheless. When I was at Event Horizon, I was also like a de facto counselor, in a sci-fi setting. Like the colony hired me to take care of, X, Y, and Z, because there's like a bunch of new cultures mm-hmm. coming together. So there was alibi in the fiction to have one, and I think a lot of them there are, but. For instance, let's see, I know Sarah is working on something right now, and I think has in several times taken the form of like a goddess, and that has been effective. I have been a director in several, there was like a director of the movie was there for a game about making a movie, and there was in a practice run, we didn't actually get to play the whole thing, but of Power Button, I got to, I was like a safety android. So there's that as well.
Oh, I'm thinking of like that therapy chat bot that is just like, tell me more.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's one of those things. That particular role broke a lot of the rules that were slowly developing, like make your embedded character like really welcoming and warm, right? So having like a cold AI was maybe not the best decision, but those roles are developing as we're going.
Yeah. Well, I'm definitely going to point people to the article on nordiclarp.org because you do a really good job of breaking down, like, here's what we would like to see in this role. Here's some concerns that we have. Here's what we're like working on. If you take on this role, here are some things that you should have. And yeah, I appreciate that. I dig that. Something thinking about the future of developing this kind of role, I think it's definitely hugely powerfully positive to have someone who is dedicated to doing emotional and in some cases psychological care for players. I think it's amazing to have that labor taken away from the default place that it would go, which is the organizers who might be amazing LARPrights and amazing organizers, but don't necessarily have any interest or expertise in doing that kind of support work. But I also wonder, like, maybe there's a danger in having just the one or the two people who are responsible for that work entirely. And I wonder, how does the counselor share that responsibility with the LARP as a whole? Like, how do you start to distribute that role a little bit in a way that is still responsible and safe and helpful?
That is good, because it sounds so, if you have a 100 player game, it sounds unlikely that you could touch base with everyone who needs it over the course of the game. And to be fair, I have missed people even, at Magiscola, where we set up, a sanctuary space with walkie-talkies that could reach either, Brody or I at any time. There was still incidents A lot of people couldn't figure out how to use the walkie-talkies, and I haven't really figured that one out yet. But there are people who just like couldn't, for whatever reason, couldn't get in contact with us. And that is something that we have to be cognizant of and have to be, able to be flexible and reschedule with. So, for instance, we make announcements, whenever if there's an in-game announcement mechanic, then, that's a great time, for instance, the counselors regret not seeing, being able to see anything. They were out doing something, fictional, whatever in character thing. And they would love to see anyone at this time at this place. Right. So unfortunately it's a bit, you are going to miss people, but you do have the responsibility to make sure that they are taken care of at the end of the day. And I think there's, as Maury Brown has written on several occasions about, creating cultures of accountability, which is, I think, maybe the most important safety feature a game can have. That contributes really greatly to the effectiveness of the counselor role because it allows for players, a network of players to come to me, right? Even if I am not with that person or I miss that person, if you have the culture of accountability, then other people are going to be aware of someone having issues and they can ultimately get that word to me very, very quickly, right?
So, I mean, for the many, many, perhaps even majority of LARPs where having one dedicated person isn't the best choice, what kinds of things do you recommend for making sure that care still happens?
I mean, there are just so many levels of safety that have been developed in 2006, 2017. Johanna has been totally out of control, making up rules. And so is Sarah and Brody and I. And so there's a lot of there's a lot of areas of redundancy when it comes to safety that can be in place. It's as much as I'm advocating for, counselors being, mandatory, especially in more intense and longer form games, sometimes that's not an option. And sometimes you just have to do really good safety design, right? You need to teach your cut and breaks and workshop them and the okay check-ins and the head downs and make sure people understand the universal consent and then most importantly, have that out of game space, right? Allow people to detach. If these are things that we have that are becoming more popular and that they're becoming staples and they're that way for a reason because they don't really take much to implement and they're just so effective.
Yeah, good. I like just contributing to the overall assumptions that those will just be there. In the same way that make sure there's enough water.
Wouldn't that be so nice? I'm running a big game at Gen this year. I'm running several, but I'm running this big 6-hour monster. And I am so much of that is I'm nervous about teaching people from con culture, especially the Gen culture is very different than others, especially in the LARP community, to teach them consent first play and to see how that catches on. I mean, I've taught it so many times now that I feel confident in that, but I want to make sure, I can't be certain that they'll be super receptive.
Right. Yeah. Or that they will have different language around it or that they will not have had the experience that tells them, oh, this is relevant and this is important. For our listeners who are going to be at Gen Con, because I have a lot of listeners who are always I want to try a LARP and I don't know where to try it because none of my friends are into it. What and when are you running at Gen Con if they want to jump in?
Oh my goodness. I'm so glad you asked. Let's see. I am I'm with a group for my larger game called Cylindrical Head Games. And we've got a game called On Beacon Hill and it will be on Saturday at 10 o'clock, 10 a.m. And it is 6 hours long and it is a pretty intense game about, I think I can be pretty transparent here. It was my attempt to queer Waco. and it is a game about, it's a siege game sort of inspired by Halat Hazar and a few others. So, it is should be very exciting. I'm also running for Games on Demand, right? Very excited about that. It's my first year. And I've got two LARPs, one by Brody. I'll be running Power Button.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. Awesome. Very exciting. And then I'm also going to be running a game I wrote this past year called Canned. And those will be Friday and Saturday at 8 p.m. So I hope to see you there.
Beautiful. My listeners who are interested in LARP, LARPs on Demand is such a, it's like the best way. Like, you just show up and there's going to be some games running. If the LARPs don't work for you, there's going to be other games there at Games on Demand. So there's just like pretty much guaranteed to be something interesting. And I know from helping organize it last year that they specifically pick LARPs that are going to appeal to people who haven't LARPed before or who are like not 100% familiar with each other. And that are well suited to the con format. So yeah, that's very exciting. So this also segues nicely into getting to ask you about your designs. I just read Canned, which is this... interesting LARP about economic insecurity and about being evaluated based on your capital P productivity and then almost certainly fired. And in doing so, deemed unworthy by the unfeeling machinery of capitalism. So I enjoyed that little read, that little summer of beach read. What has been your experience of running it so far? Because it seems like it's so brutally dark, I could almost get into like satirical territory. But then the more that I read it, I'm like, no, I don't think this would be funny at all, actually.
Right. It's more brutal than I originally anticipated. I have not run it yet, but Jason has.
Oh, cool.
So, and I have Jason's notes from it, which have informed it. I've done some, rehearsal play, which is not like we play out mechanics and play out certain aspects of it. Mm-hmm. But running it its entirety will actually really be a first for me. It's way darker than I anticipated, but I was very much drawn to actually not to like what is it gush on you too much, but like you definitely like your podcast helped inspire it. I'm sure you have noticed your name in the thank you portion. Because like when you were asking everyone about like how your games fight fascism, I was like, wow, yeah, like fuck, how do games do that? Like, I want my games to fight fascism. that's awesome. I'm very direct in things. And I think that became, that's pretty obvious in that design. It's very blunt. It's very, very anti-capitalist. It's very, it talks very specifically about, capitalist standards, capitalist productivity standards and how those are, toxic and how we're supposed to deal with those.
Right. And it's, I've been thinking a lot about subtlety in LARP recently. I think it's because I've been playing a lot of like hashtag feminism games where some of those are very like, here's the lesson, motherfucker, learn it. And then some are like, here's what this is kind of about. And then you play it and you're like, oh, okay, interesting. And then and some you kind of you think you know what they're about. And then through playing them, you're like, oh, okay, I'm having this experience that isn't 100% what I thought it was. And I'm sort of learned, like, normally if something lacks subtlety or if it's, like, too obvious, I can get really, like, snooty about it.
Right.
But I'm just kind of, like, really digging a lack of subtlety these days. I don't know why exactly.
Yeah. I feel the same way in that. I dislike it. Especially, there was a really good, like, design note in Jason Morningstar's Old Friends. That's, like... I think it's a note for players, but it's like, it says, don't be clever, be obvious. And that, for some reason, that really stuck with me when I played that game, as a player. But then also as a designer afterward, and I've been trying to, incorporate it because so much is LARP translates very strangely. And I don't want to offer a theory of how or why it's that way. I just know it does from experience that if you read a script or if 10 groups read a script, you're going to get 10 very, different games, for the most part. And so, being very, very direct, I think, helps communicate what the artist's vision is. So you have that as guidance while you're playing it.
Do you think there's a time to ignore artist vision?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, always. So I went to the School of the Art Institute of Chicago for my undergrad, and it's sort of a you really learn about like sort of like capital A art, very like white wall, purebred art, right? Very conceptual in nature, all that. And a lot of it is, you know, teaching you that like art cannot be like removed from artist, that like the two things are inseparable. Like it is inherent context of a piece of, but then I've been doing a lot of it actually in pursuit of another game, Helasco. I read a lot of literature criticism theory, basically that like, about ways to remove the author from your analysis. And I've been focusing on that a lot too. And just like, what's the value of just looking at a script and being able to play off that? And maybe there is value to it being open to so many interpretations. So I think you have to design for that though.
Interesting. What do you mean by that?
Canned is very political, and I don't want people fucking with that message. It's like very, very clear, right? Like I do not like capitalism, and it like hurts people, and further oppresses marginalized people, especially like folks with disability. It's very clear, and so I don't want any ambiguity in the way that's played. Like the themes are very explicit, even sort of the tone is very explicit, and that's important to me. However, I think there's various ways you can play. It's not even like it has been, but like Monster Hearts, right? So many people, I always love hearing people's interpretation of like Monster Heart and how and what their table does with it. It's always so different and like would never have worked in my group. Like it does not, it, like the ideas just inherently clash. Like that, you know, it's impossible. But like it really, really worked for them and they just interpreted it in this really different way. Another Avery game that's super vague. In terms of how it's played, is like a place to fuck each other.
Oh yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's great game. If highly recommend it. But it is like very vague in terms of like how you sort of how it's played and like the how sort of the conditions in which a scene ends are just like very like I feel this at this point and that's your cue to end it. And so that gameplay is really ambiguous, but opens to a lot of really. But wouldn't exist without it, right? If you had like a hard set condition in which it ended, you wouldn't be it wouldn't achieve the goal of like personal exploration about those queer spaces.
Okay, so some games are more interpretable than others. I can definitely hear you there. It's funny though, you talk about this idea of being able to engage with a work separate from the person who made it. But you have this LARP called, well, what I find interesting is that your LARP adaptation of the short story Killing the Second Dog by Marek Hlasko is just called Hlasko. And I didn't 100% get that title at first. And now it's like a really intriguing title to me because you literally just named it the artist behind the piece of art. And I read the LARP, but I haven't played it. And now I'm wondering like, Is that like a theme in that game? Is that something that you're playing with in there?
Oh, absolutely. One of the reasons I love that book so much is it's so like Merrick is such a cool figure. If you know nothing about him, he's sort of like the James Dean of Polish literature, right? He's very he's kind of a heartthrob and he's tragic and cool and. You know, so he's a very interesting character in and of himself. And then he writes this book, like Killing a Second Dog. And it's so like, obviously, in many, many ways, autobiographical. And once you sort of compare like his biography and, you know, the material, it's so obviously about him, but also about mythologizing himself in so many and distancing himself in certain capacities, right? And he shows up in sort of every character almost, bits and pieces of him. And so while writing it, I really wanted for it to be like a true autobiography or a true adaptation, I'm sorry, would be, it would need to include that because that's such a core part of it. So I want people playing it to really put as much of themselves into it as possible. That's why the characters are very thin, as are, you're encouraged, multiple times throughout the script to play it close to home. And even the mechanics talk about mythologizing and recontextualizing personal issues for content, like to the fiction.
Okay, interesting. I feel like I'm really starting to wrap my mind around this because the content of the story is just like devastating realism.
Yeah.
Like it's just completely devastating. And it doesn't seem to have that kind of overt political goal in the way that Canned does. So there obviously is a time for subtlety.
Absolutely. I think also, so there's also a limitation. Canned was written for Golden Cobra this year. So it has certain limitations on it and being very blunt and very direct, right, are good tools if you're limited in time and resources. But also like the nature of it, it's like communist literature, right? It is that thing, and it has to come across that way too in tone and feel, and that's very direct, and it hits like a sledgehammer. But you know, where Halasko is about like existentialism and like sort of the human condition of being really fucking miserable, and that's a lot. That's a much more subtle. A much more subtle feeling. That's harder to put into words.
Has Halasko been played much? Have you heard much about that being played?
Imagine, it's funny. No one wants to play Halasko. But
really, there's no one wants to play your like devastating post-war Israel.
I would love for people to. I think Jason is interested. We're trying to like push those games out there as much as possible, and I encourage other people to do that too, right? Like you have like a cool group of friends, especially like my LARP community is like queer and trans and like safety oriented. It's rather small for that reason, but like it's a huge priority of mine to push their work out. I've been trying to, show Brody's games and as soon as Janaea releases hers, I want to show everyone in the whole world. Consequently, they too, like, throw me a bone and like, well, maybe play Halasko.
You're just like trying to accrue enough goodwill that eventually people will be like, okay, we'll go for it.
Yeah. So I think it is like a pretty devastating game, although I feel the format supports, the ability to distance yourself from it a fair bit. And there's some real, really fun moments, I feel at least, right? Like the one thing that Jason and Morningstar commented about it was like, you have like managed to crack the code on role-playing a long con, which is something really fun in and of itself. That's something everyone wants to play. And we have examples of like games that are cons, like for instance, like Jason's Out of Dodge, right? Yeah. And then there's also like Contrapposto, and that's like a con or like a heist, right? And those are fun things to do, but playing a long con is a bit more difficult to conceptualize and to design for. And I think it does that well. And it also is really fun to just be sort of like a part of a con that's, you sort of like slowly chip away at all the angles. And unfortunately, the result is that you're doing this to like a human life. And that's really sad.
Right, right. So there is this, there's a structure of fun underneath that, even if the reality of it is, cruel and exploitative.
Yeah, and there's a really good scene where you get to put on another play in jail, and that's a fun scene. I think it would be. I've actually done that scene a few times. It's great fun. So there's at least some, you know, relief.
Right, because it's not devastating for the sake of devastating, even if it may be exploring themes for the sake of exploring them, and not for an explicit political goal.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, I'm very compelled.
Good. Well, if you like ever find yourself wanting to play a three-player game, like Halaska's out there.
That's true. I feel like that's pretty accessible. Three players. It's not too hard to wrangle that many.
I know.
And now I have it. Okay. Can I link to it in the show notes?
Oh, yeah, please.
Beautiful. And also, I feel like this wraps around to what we were talking about care in LARPs, right? Because I think it's good to remind ourselves every now and again that, like, caring for each other has inherent value, but also part of the reason why it's necessary and part of the reason why it's interesting is because when we have those kinds of, like, when we have that kind of scaffolding in place, those are the places you can go, right? Like, you shouldn't go to those kinds of emotional places about, like, people in desperate situations ruining each other's lives if you don't have a safety net. But if you do, then you can explore those, and it's okay to do.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I fight a lot with people about, in the LARP community, about, like, what are the lines of, like, what we can do and what we can't do is, ethically is really important to me, in design and play. But I think you're allowed to, you know, the things that we can play, or should be able to play, so often are these, difficult subjects, and the ones that are getting written about so frequently now, right? Everyone's just like is on this kick. I think we're actually getting over this, which is kind of cool, but like for a while everyone just wanted to write like the saddest game ever, which is I think coming to an end. I'm really excited about that.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
I think one of the categories for the Golden Cobras this year is the game that gives us the most hope.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yay, good.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be Canned.
not plug in for that one.
Yeah. I had the privilege of I designed the 2016 anthology for the Golden Cobras, and so I got to spend a lot of time with all of those games, and I reread all of them like several times through, and it was like they're just so cool. Oh,
it's an exciting time. Okay, what's like one thing that you are really excited about for the future?
Great. I am so excited. I'm actually taking a little break after Gen Con to like it's a little burnt on LARP and game, but I'm really looking forward to getting back into it in November and going to Kentucky with Brody Atwater to teach meta techniques at a medieval boffer and start my diabolical plan to queer boffer.
I'm so excited. What can you tell us about that plan?
Okay.
About your machinations.
So it's like very theory driven. Essentially that I joke about like I'm queering boffer sort of there to like because I'm there to ruin it or whatever, right? or spoil everyone's fun. And I'm really not. but I think it's really fair to argue that boffer is predominantly played through a patriarchal lens that reinforces gender norms and toxic masculinity. And I don't feel like I really need to like validate that, but if I had to, right. If you were going to press me on it, I think, it's like, it's just a community that took societal norms of the status quo. Like it's white supremacist, cis heteronormative, Christian, capitalist, ableist patriarchy. And then it like, does a lot of really dangerous things, and that like it creates a community based on those things, and they don't put like marginalized people at the forefront, which I think is really the key in creating communities these days. Is like, you know, like pushing those individuals to the forefront. Otherwise, those communities will like inevitably inherit those oppressive qualities, and they don't, as evidence, because like Mo Turkington and Janaea Kemper would have their own kingdoms by now, right? And then you like contextualize all that chaos in like into like an oppressive setting, like, you know, medieval jousting or whatever, you know,
what white people thought the Midura was like,
and that perception's so important. Like pick your any like your favorite medieval boffer as an example, and it's like high key problematic, you know, hashtag not all boffer, but whatever. And then it does like this really scary thing where it distances itself from the underlying facts for the sake of genre. So like, huzzah, we can do all these things now. And then it adds alibi, because all LARP does. And that makes it really, really scary for marginalized people. So like, it is this, so I also accept that not only is the fiction itself sort of oppressive, but the framework governing it also is. And so like, there was an article that came out not long ago called Privilege, Power, and Dungeons and Dragons. And it talks about how the effect game systems have on marginalized identities and their expression and play, and how systems affect, societal expression within those the confines of that. But on another level, we can accept that if a game system, you know, doesn't allow you to jump, then you can't jump. And if your game allows you to jump, then you're probably going to jump. And if your game not only allows you to jump, but incentivizes it, then you're going to spend a lot of time jumping. And so like the systems are the modes of how folks move through the world and engage one another. The point being is, my thoughts are that by like removing players from that context and those frameworks and recontextualizing those characters into like a freeform black box setting of like my control or our control, you know, one government governed by like femininity, consent, respect, trust, run by like queer people, we are in fact queering it, if only for that scene. Mm-hmm. But like my thought is that because the diegesis accepts all contribution to that fiction equally, it's sort of like forever queer, whether they like it or not.
So you're sort of infecting this mode of play, and you're just releasing stuff that can't be sort of put back.
That's my hope, right? And the idea ultimately is like to teach black box to this community, right? To a medieval boffer group, and like so. That they can keep using it, right? So we're basically going down there to like hand them tools that they can, you know, teach other people how to use, and so they can do like cool black box stuff in their medieval boffer. And that's really, really cool. And I hope that that like it sticks, or they find those tools valuable in some capacity.
Yeah. And whatever degree of also political unrest you may or may not elicit, you know, that's cool. That's good.
Yeah. I mean, it's cool. I think the world will be a little gayer afterwards, and that's fine by me. So.
Yeah. God, what else can we hope for? That sounds beautiful. I'm really looking forward to how that goes and hearing what the effect of that is.
Me too.
So yeah, you should tell me all about it.
Great on. I definitely will.
Well, if my listeners want to keep up with you and hear how all of that goes and see what else you're publishing and putting out there and making, where should they do that?
Well, I think so. People keep Googling me these days, and I don't. Oh man, it's just like nothing comes up because I've done a pretty good job covering myself. Because you know, you do stuff online when you're younger, right? But so basically, the only place that you can find me at this point is. It's Twitter. You can follow me at Spooky Slag. And it's really not, it's super not safe for work, but I really hope you follow me because, and I'll follow you because that's basically where I LARP rant. So
it's good stuff. It's quality content.
thank you.
Okay, good. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. This was really exciting, really cool.
This was incredibly special to me, and I'm like going to hold on to this for a long time. Posted about it in a bunch of, I have like a secret group on Facebook with Janaea and Brody. And I was like, oh my God, today's the day. So anyways, so it's been really special for me. So thank you.
Oh, yay. That's wonderful. I'm like beaming right now. I'm going to take that with me for the rest of the day and just like float on it.
Well, thanks again to Alex for joining us. And as always, thank you for listening. Remember that if you have thoughts on today's episode, you can always email me. That's backstorypodcast@gmail.com. Or you can tweet at me. That's @backstorycast. Backstory is part of the One Shot Podcast Network. You can go to oneshotpodcast.com and find more great shows like Modifier. Modifier is an interview podcast with host Megan Dornbrock that's changing the game when it comes to changing games. Designers of every level are invited to discuss what prompted them to hack a game, the kind of play experiences they seek to create, and the types of stories they're hoping to tell. That's Megan Dornbrock at oneshotpodcast.com. Music for Backstory is provided by Ujiko. The track is called Thinking of You, and you can hear more at soundcloud.com/UJICO. Talk to you later, heroes.